A sky original. Against a black background, the words Goldcrest loom forwards, a small bird resting above the D and C of the logo. A small pink line appears. Splitting in two to form two small leaves, it slides to the left to form the letter A of the word align. Panning backwards, silver letters form into view reading lip sync. A small white bird drops a stick from its mouth, which stretches out to underline the Atticus Film and Television logo. Sky presents a Sky Original. Goldcrest and Align present in association with Lip Sync. An Atticus Film production. A film by John Hay. Starring Hugh Bonneville as Roald Dahl. Keely Hawes as Patricia Neal. Conleth Hill as Marty Ritt. Jeffrey Palmer as Jeffrey Fisher. Michael Gibson as Pete Perkins. And Sam Heughan as Paul Newman. Introducing Isabella Johnson, Darcy Ewart, Bobby O'Neill, and Bodie Marson. Based on Patricia Neal, An Unquiet Life by Stephen Michael Shearer. Written by John Hay and David Logan. Casting director Suzanne Smith. Makeup and hair designer Katie Pix-Pickles. Costume designer Susie Harmon. Music composed by Debbie Wiseman. Editor Colin Gowdy, BFE. Production designer Richard Bullock. Director of photography Graham Frake, BSc. Executive producers Nadia Kamlicci, Nessa McGill, Norman Merry, Peter Hamden, David Kennedy, Gretchen McGowan, John Hay and Hugh Williams. Producers Nick Quested, Adrian Politowski, Martin Metz and Donald McCusker. Directed by John Hay. In cartoon form, the silhouette of a fox passes by as a tall man walks towards a white shed with yellow door and enters. A full moon shines brightly in the starry sky above. It disappears to form the outline of the letter O. To Olivia. Nighttime. The bright headlights of a vehicle appear cutting through the darkness. They belong to a car and illuminate a dark country road as they pass over it. Now in a village, the car slows, passing other stationary vehicles. Lights shine out from the windows of a building as the car parks up beside it. A tall figure wearing a long trench coat steps out and places on a fedora hat as they walk towards the building. Reaching the door, they pull it open and enter. Inside, a group of children sit on the floor of a hall before a stage, on which there is a solitary chair. Adults stand to the side of the room chatting. England, November 1961. A large bowl of ripe peaches sits on the edge of the stage.
Are they for us?
No one said we can.
No one said we can't, though. Right.
The cherub-faced young boy rises and approaches the bowl of fruit. Picking one out, he holds it up to his mouth and closes his eyes as he bites down into it. The fruit thief looks up as the silhouette of the tall figure in brimmed hat and long coat approaches him. The man stops in the spotlight and looks down at the suddenly nervous-looking boy.
May I have one?
Reaching down, he hands a peach to the mysterious stranger.
Thank you.
With hat now removed, the man stands and eats the fruit.
Oh, yes, lovely. It's a particularly good one.
Come on, everyone. Come and get one.
The cross-legged children rise from the floor and excitedly rush towards the stage, before each taking a peach from the bowl. The tall man places his hat on an empty seat in the middle of the stage and removes his coat as the children retake their positions. Hanging his coat on the seat, the young audience enjoy their fruit as the tall man steps down from the stage and, finishing his own peach, sits down cross-legged before them.
My name is Roald Dahl. Now, some of you may be wondering why there was a bowl with peaches in it. Well, that's because I've written a book about a peach, a magical one. And what I'm going to do today is read you some of it.
Hey, what about this stone?
Oh, you think you can get it in the bowl from there?
Easy.
Is it? Yes, all right. I tell you what. How about backwards?
The author throws his peach stone over his shoulder. The smiling children shuffle round on the floor, now also facing away from the stage. They too begin to toss their redundant fruit stones backwards. Roald smiles, holding his arms up to protect himself from the projectiles. Wooden cocktail sticks skewer chunks of cheese and pineapple. A man picks one up, examines the food, then raises it up to his mouth, eating only the cheese. Turning away from the buffet, he approaches the cherub-faced young boy, who stands chatting to Roald, and taps the child on the shoulder.
Augustus?
Daddy.
Caught the tail end. Very amusing.
Thank you.
Pete Perkins.
What is?
That's my name.
Is that so? Good for you.
Consider myself a bit of a wordsmith, actually. A few poems here and there.
The old colourful limerick at university. That sort of thing.
I definitely think I've got a book or two in me. Not a children's book, of course. Something a bit weightier.
Weightier?
Mm. Well done for Johnny and the Giant.
Pineapple. Oh,
thank you, yes.
Johnny and the Giant Pineapple. We've all got to start somewhere, haven't we?
I did originally think peach.
No. Kids can relate to a pineapple.
Pineapple's the one.
I should give you my card. If things pick up for you, you might need a decent solicitor. Much more than just a lawyer, you know. Dog with a bone. That's what I am. And that's exactly what someone like you needs. If I was your dog with a bone, I would be 120% committed to... What's that? Isn't that...
Clotubarada next to...
Patricia Neal.
Who?
Oh, come on. Patricia Neal, huge, great big American movie star. How did she get here?
Transport wise.
No. What's she doing here at this sorry little affair in the middle of nowhere?
Probably the wrong address. You know, actresses, none too bright, but nice to look at.
Rather.
Well, she's nothing special. The sort of girl I'd sooner have wrapped round my finger.
In your dreams, old chap.
No, really? I don't know if you're a betting man, Mr. Perkins, but 10 bob says that I leave with Patricia Neal tonight.
Hmm? Okay. I'll take your money.
Gus can be banker. Hmm?
Roald signals with his head towards the other man as they approach the actress.
Miss Neal, allow me to introduce myself. I'm Roald Dahl.
The Roald Dahl.
One and the same. And this is my good friend, Jerry Jenkins.
It's lovely to meet you, Mr. Jenkins.
Perkins, actually. Pete Perkins.
I'm sorry, I knew it was something along those lines. And this is Gus, Augustus, really. But he prefers Gus, don't you, Gus?
Pleasure to meet you, Gus.
Wow.
A funny thing, Patricia, if I may. Pete here has just bet me 10 shillings that I don't leave with you tonight.
Leave with me as in... Well, Mr. Jenkins, really.
It wasn't my...
Oh, come now. Didn't you just say that actresses are none too bright, but nice to look at?
No, you just said that...
So how about it, Pat? I've a nice little place the other side of Amersham.
Well, Mr. Dahl, I'm flattered by your offer, but I'm not sure my husband would approve.
Oh, you're married. Oh, what a shame.
Although I have to say, I am a bit of a sucker for a tall man.
That's a bit of luck. Any other qualities you look for?
Well, let me think now. There is one thing I can't resist. That's a man who cooks a good breakfast.
Well... Miss Neal, I have to tell you that back in Great Missenden, they call me the King of Breakfast.
Oh, do they now?
Hey, what about your husband?
I won't tell him if you don't.
So good to have met you, Gus. No.
Mr. Jenkins.
Jerry.
Augustus smiles at his stony-faced father as they watch the couple leave.
You, Mr. Dahl, are one big kid.
Is that so?
And the day you start is the day I file for a divorce.
Roald opens the door onto a sprawling garden, a child playing near a small white-walled shed.
We had two daughters. The first we called Olivia. Olivia 20 Dahl. Olivia from Twelfth Night. 20 because that's all the money I had in my pocket on the bright sunny day she was born. Olivia, our little zookeeper. Then there was Chantal Sophia Dahl. Sophia after my mother. But we realised she'd be Chantal Dahl. So she became Tessa. Tessa, who always agreed the best approach was to do things her own way, including sleeping anywhere she could, so long as it wasn't in her bed. And Theo, the boy we nearly lost in a traffic accident on a wet winter road in New York City. Then, of course, Pat, star of stage and screen, now trying to keep her career and her family afloat in a rickety old tub we called Gypsy House.
Pat sits alone at the kitchen table. Out in the garden, Roald runs with the dark-haired Olivia, his arms outstretched. They pass a white goat before a small grey dog joins them. Olivia leads her father towards a large white ornate cage filled with birds.
Gabriel's wings better now.
It is, isn't it?
He's not Gabriel, he's Uriel.
Do you call them all after angels?
They are all angels.
Angels that shit everywhere, that's for sure.
Come on.
Now in the village.
And his name is Charlie Rocket.
Daddy, I love that you call him that.
He lives in a little house with his mother and father and his father's mother and father and his mother's mother and father.
All in one house?
All in one bed.
Living poor, you see, poor, and all called Bob.
All called Bob?
Yes, and both grandmothers are called Roberta. Then there's Grandpa Robert and Mother Grandpa Robert.
That's funny.
I don't know. Might work.
What sweets do they make?
Oh, incredible ones.
Fudge? Can there be fudge?
Oh, yes, there'll be a whole lake of it.
And gobstoppers.
Oh, yes, they're your favourite, aren't they?
Yeah, but they never last long enough.
Well, these ones will. In fact, these will last forever. It's the P.T. Barnum confectionery. It made a palace entirely out of chocolate for a Maharaja once. Prince Pilau. No. Prince Peeper Peepoo. Yes, probably not that either. It'll come to me.
Olivia runs off ahead of her father, disappearing through a dark opening between the trees. She stops looking up at a dilapidated building stood before her in the woodland, before running to a corrugated metal fence at its rear.
Careful!
Pushing a flap of metal to the side, Olivia stares through an opening into a large empty room of the building. Roald joins her.
Don't know why you like it so much.
It's a shivery smile.
A shivery smile.
Roald glances at his daughter, admiring her thought. Letting the metal panel fall back over the opening, they walk away hand in hand.
The other thing that our man likes is to make fountains out of sugar. Gets a bit sticky.
Pat still sits alone at the kitchen table, drinking from a teacup and smoking, as the small blonde-haired Tessa enters the kitchen and approaches her.
When's Libby going to be home?
They won't be too much longer, darling. Go find something to play until they get back.
But I've played everything.
Well, you can't have played everything.
I have, really.
Now, do you remember what Mommy said about having to work?
Uh-huh. And I was only to disturb you if it was an emergency.
That's right.
Like now.
Stopping, her mother stares at her.
And what is the emergency? Your feet are on fire!
Pat chases Tessa.
Pixies, they're sneaky as gunnets they are. Do all sorts they do when they've got their back turned. But the thing about pixies, they go... But right quiet like, so you've got to keep a lug oil peeled to hear him.
Why are you talking like that?
Mommy's practicing, darling.
What's all this?
We're looking for pixies.
Pixies? In Buckinghamshire? Well, fat chance. No, you only get pixies in Cornwall.
But Mummy said...
Well, silly Mummy. You know, Daddy, Daddy is right. In Buckinghamshire, we get fairies.
Fairies? You got fairies?
Well, yes, that's right. But the trouble with fairies, you see, is they're terribly shy. And so it's quite hard to see them.
Yes. But unless it's the 3rd of November, of course.
When's that?
Well, how incredible. That's today. What are the chances? And today is Bubba-Lubba-Dum-Dum Day.
What's Bubba-Lubba-Day?
Bubba-Lubba-Dum-Dum Day is the day that Opple-Topple, king of the fairies, leads a parade on a big black rabbit.
Like Trilby.
Exactly like Trilby.
Can we see it?
Oh, well, now, let me think.
Here, darling. Oh.
Nothing yet?
Oh, no.
All right, Daddy, you'll come. Mummy's got to take an important call about a part. Well, well.
Do you think King Appleflapple will like it?
Oppletopple? Of course he will. It's magnificent.
Can we see him on his rabbit?
Well, as long as it's not past bath time. Oh, dear, which it is.
But, Daddy, you said we could if you made a tribble.
Tribute.
So can we?
We'll have to see in the morning.
This isn't one of your stories, is it?
Rold gives Olivia a look.
You'll see.
He stands watching as his elder daughter leads her sister back towards the house and smiles. Now in the kitchen, Pat sits as the two girls run round the table. Tessa knocks a pile of papers to the floor as she passes, causing her mother to rise in frustration.
Come here! Lily, I said not red ones. Mummy has to pay those.
Sorry.
An overdue bill has a picture of the birdcage drawn on it.
Is that what you want? You want them to fly away, do you, Lily?
They come back.
I admire your optimism.
They will. It's their home.
Rold glances at Pat.
Go and run your bath, will you?
The girls leave the kitchen as he looks down at his fed-up wife.
I'm weathering on the vine here.
Darling, they say who they're going with.
Rachel Roberts.
Got the right sort of earthiness to her, I suppose.
And I don't.
They're just used to seeing you in a fox fur drinking a martini.
Well, what does that mean? It's all I'm good for?
That's not what I'm saying.
Well, it doesn't matter. I've still got that crappy airport thing.
Well, like I said, don't do it if you don't want to.
That is ripe, coming from a man whose last advance wouldn't even cover a case of that scotch you're always so fond of downing.
My writing pays.
It'd pay a hell of a lot more if you weren't so bloody-minded.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means kids want Enid Blyton. Not the twisted crap that comes out of your head.
Oh, sod you, Pat. I was only bloody trying to be nice.
He walks out, leaving her sat alone. Cigarette in hand, she closes her eyes as she sucks down on it. Now outside, Rold walks with a bottle in his hand towards his shed.
You can shut up.
Passing the birdcage, he continues on down the garden towards the shed and approaching its yellow door, pushes it open and enters before closing it behind him. Now inside, Rold switches on a desk lamp, then a 3-bar electric heater, before he settles under a rug sat beside a desk. Pencil shavings are brushed away before a yellow pencil is pushed into an electric sharpener. Rold has formed a large ball of silver foil, which he rolls on the green tray on his knee. Rold places the ball to the side, then, as he looks up, the ghost of a small boy dressed in a grey school uniform of blazer, shorts and cap appears walking into view before him.
Now, where were we?
Chapter 5.
Yes, the River of Marshmallow.
You're going to drink all that?
You're starting to sound like our mother.
The ghostly boy blinks as Rold fills his glass, replaces the stopper in the bottle and places it down. Lifting the glass, he drinks from the well-filled vessel. Now at night, a full moon shines above the house. Inside, Pat sits alone in the living room, also drinking from a glass and smoking a cigarette. still in his writing shed, Rode briefly stops working to drain another drink. In the living room, Pat looks unsteady on her feet as she stands before crossing the room. Stepping out from his white brick office, Rode stands by the door. Ahead is the ramshackle fairy tribute made by his daughters from Styx. He looks away. In the house, Pat places a 7-inch record onto a blue record player. Now on the lawn, Rode pours liquid from a canister onto the grass. Hearing the music, he turns around. Inside, Pat dances alone, then lights another cigarette. Bending down, Rode lifts a stone and throws it at the living room window. Stepping back onto the lawn, Rode returns to emptying the canister onto the grass. Wearing a coat, Pat appears out of the house and looks at him in a questioning manner.
What are you doing?
Some message for the kids.
You're drunk.
You said you'd thrown that away.
Well, I bought it again.
How would you feel,
It's just a stupid song.
No, being compared to Gary Cooper.
He's dead. You know, even if he wasn't, he wouldn't be stumbling around with a can of weed killer trying to keep our kids happy, would he?
No, because Cooper wouldn't be his wife.
She stares at him blankly.
You're an idiot.
Oh, what was that? Was that an apology?
Best you're going to get.
Well, I'll take it.
What?
Where are you going? Yeah, help me. Come here.
An arm held across her chest from behind, Rode spins Pat round. Tessa's face appears at the window before being joined by her mother and father. On the grass in the garden below, a message has been scorched into the lawn. Thank you, Olivia and Tessa.
Where is Olivia?
Olivia is in bed.
Livy? Sweetie? Livy?
Rold enters and sits on the bed as Pat checks their daughter's brow.
And then about 2 o'clock in the morning, you see the owls arrive every day.
Owls?
Yes. Specially trained to make chocolate.
That's so clever, Daddy.
No, it's not.
What would you know?
I know owls eat slugs and nobody wants chocolate made by owls, all covered in yucky slug slime.
Well, there were all sorts of bugs in Peach.
And no one bought it, Mummy said.
A stern Rode turns to her.
Go to bed.
That's not fair.
I said go to bed.
Tessa storms out as her father bows his head.
Everyone worried this one, Daddy.
Pat enters the room. Rode looks up at her as she sits on the bed beside Olivia.
You need to sleep now, Livy.
Tired.
Well, he's right. Anyway. Ta-da.
You said real animals.
It is a real animal. It's a jumble flum.
Daddy.
Go to sleep, darling.
Good night.
Pat stands and leaves.
Te amo, little one.
Te amo, dear Peter.
Rode leaves his daughter lying in bed with eyes closed, her arms tightly by her side. Nighttime, the outside of his writing shed comes into focus. Inside, Rode writes as the ghostly young schoolboy paces the floor. Eyes wide open, Olivia is still laid on her back in bed as her mother enters, sitting down beside her. The ghostly young apparition continues to pace before Rode. Pat touches emotionless Olivia's face, then forehead, before rushing away. In the shed, a light bulb begins to pulse on and off. Rode looks up, noticing it. Now the bright lights of an ambulance drive down a dark road. In the back of the vehicle, the author sits with his unconscious daughter touching her forehead. Mangold sits, smoke drifting from the cigarette in his hand. He is alone in a long corridor, a nurse in a blue dress further down the hallway from him. Looking up, he sees a doctor speaking to another nurse before they disappear into a room. As he looks away, Pat appears in their place, and seeing her husband, she runs towards him.
Ronald?
They think it might be encephalitis.
I don't understand. Well, it's just measles. Measles doesn't cause swelling.
No, in rare cases.
Pat sits by an unconscious Olivia's bedside, holding her hand. Roald sits on the end of the bed. Turning to her husband, Pat takes his hand and encourages him down to kneel by the bed alongside her. As his wife bows her head, Roald remains upright, eyes open. Later, a young doctor in a white coat walks slowly down a corridor, a booklet of paper in his hand. He passes by Roald, who watches as the medic approaches Pat, sat in a chair against the wall.
Sorry, if you wouldn't mind, I collect them? Autographs, I mean.
Holding the book out, Pat still takes it, but struggles to hold back tears before scribbling her signature. Pat is back at Olivia's bedside, Roald sat nearby, the young girl now attached to a drip. The author looks round and stands as a doctor enters. The man passes by the author and, placing a stethoscope in his ears, leans over Olivia to check her breathing.
She'll sleep now. No need for both of you to stay. Now you go. Tessa and Thea will be... well, they need you.
Roald holds Pat's coat as she stands. The worried mother adjusts Olivia's bed sheets, then leaning down kisses her on the cheek. She then lifts her bag as Roald helps her arms into her jacket. Turning to him, he wraps his arms around his wife, holding her close, before they part, letting go of each other's hands only as Pat walks away and exits the ward. Roald sits back down at his daughter's bedside. Later, he is asleep, his head on a table as figures rush by him. Waking, he looks up to see Olivia's bed surrounded by doctors and nurses. Daytime. At home, Pat is asleep in bed, Tessa beside her. The slumbering woman wakes and rolls onto her back. Now she rushes down the stairs, dressed in a long pale blue nightdress, and lifts the telephone receiver.
Roald?
Her hand leant on a table, Pat briefly loses her grip.
No. No.
Pat's hand remains on the table for support. Now in a cemetery. All dressed in dark clothes, Roald and Pat stand either side of Tessa. Her parents' gaze is fixed on the ground as the young girl looks around. A priest walks away from the graveside, other mourners following after him. Pat looks round, seeing them go, and follows after, leaving father and daughter alone. The final mourners disperse, and as Pat slowly walks away, they are visible by the grave, stood together. The young girl looks up at her father and holds a hand out. He ignores this gesture and walks away, leaving Tessa on her own, an arm still held out from her side as she watches him go. The young girl stands alone by the mound of earth marking her sister's grave. Now inside the house, Pat carries a plate of sandwiches.
Thank you for coming, of course. You need anything. You need me to look after children. Anything. Thank you.
Pat walks away.
I'm so sorry to hear about dear little Olivia.
Aiden, Chris, excuse me.
A bread knife slices into a loaf of bread.
Pat.
We've run out of egg and cress.
Tessa watches from beneath a table as the priest reaches a hand out and presses it against her mother's elbow. Pat slowly sits down and holds a hand up to her mouth.
Where's Roald?
A tearful Pat holds a hand to her mouth, shaking her head. In Olivia's bedroom, Roald kneels by an open wooden chest.
Roald?
May as well get on with it.
Everyone's still here.
Ignoring her, he puts away a book.
Please, please stop.
I'll be down in a minute.
But she's Matilda. No, she's Tessa's.
No, she's not. She's...
Olivia's.
Please, don't.
Damn it, Roald. Her name is Olivia. What, we're not even allowed to say her name now? Why can't you just cry like a normal person?
As Pat watches, Roald continues placing toys into the trunk. Realising the futility of the situation, she leaves the room as he places in the final few items and closes down the wooden lid. Daytime. Snow covers the grass in the garden of the Dahl family home. Birds flutter in the large white cage. Inside, Tessa sits alone near the bottom of the stairs. Cuddly toys sit beside her, and picking them up, she cuddles them on her lap.
Everybody hold hands.
The young girl clutches on tightly. Stood alone in Olivia's now empty room, Pat walks across to the chair and, reaching down, she lifts a small item, holding it in her hand and looking at it. She clasps her hand tightly. Outside, the garden is covered in a layer of freezing white. In Roald's writing shed, the 3-bar electric fire glows a bright orange. A blanket covering his knees, the author abruptly places down his pencil. The ghostly schoolboy watches as Roald reaches across and lifts a glass, then drinks down the contents. Placing it back down, he lifts a bottle from the floor and, removing the stopper, tips it into the glass. Only a trickle of liquid splashes out, leaving the writer frustrated. Roald bursts into the scullery, the empty bottle in his hand. Tessa looks up, sitting on a rug, a tea party set out for her cuddly toys. She shrinks back as he turns, knocking his head on a wooden beam.
What are you doing?
Not a bad thing.
Staring down at his daughter, Roald slowly steps forwards and bends down.
You playing tea?
He counts round the places, then stops and holds out an accusatory finger.
Who's that place for?
Nobody.
Don't lie! That's...
Roald!
Mummy.
What the hell? It's not just you who's lost living.
It hurts.
It hurts us all. You can't scream at her just because...
It's not for her! It's for Matilda, for my dolly. You said she's not mine, but she is!
Come back to us, Roald. Please.
Roald looks chastened as he steps towards his wife and daughter. Pat holds out a hand, which she ignores, reaching over her to pick up a fresh bottle of whiskey before walking away and leaving the room.
All right, Laura, is there enough tea for me?
Come on. Nighttime. Roald walks alone outside, his head down, looking deep in thought. Cigarette in hand, Pat appears out from the side of the house as he approaches.
You want to lose 2 daughters?
Ignoring his wife, he walks past her and enters the house. Pat watches him go, then exhales a long stream of smoke from her mouth. Inside, Roald walks slowly along a dimly lit hallway. Reaching a doorway, he takes a deep breath and enters.
Tessa.
Tessa's bed lies untouched. Swinging his gaze round the room, her father sees a red coat hanging on the wardrobe. Looking down, Roald notices a cuddly toy being quickly dragged under the bed. Kneeling down, he lifts the edge of the red bedspread, to reveal his sad-looking young daughter lying curled up on a pillow.
You look cosy. You know what I was thinking? I was thinking about the circus. Remember the circus? You do, don't you? You remember what you said after we came out? What you said about the lions being your favorite?
It was her.
No, it was you, darling. She liked them.
No, it was her. And then you said you liked them best too, because you only ever liked what she liked.
Tessa rolls over away from her father. Roald continues to watch her, then drops the bedspread back down. Tessa's eyes move back in his direction. Morning. Roald and Pat lie in bed asleep, facing away from one another. The writer stirs and rising lifts off the covers before sitting up on the edge of the bed. Now downstairs, Roald is in the kitchen. Hearing a noise, he moves over to the window. Pulling back the curtain, he sees Tessa urging all the birds out of the cage. As Roald watches on, Pat carries Tessa towards the house. He quickly checks the cage, then looks back towards them. Later, sun breaks through the trees as the door of the cage swings back and forth. A cigarette in his hand, Roald sits alone in his writing shed. The ghostly schoolboy stands with his back to the author, who stares straight ahead, a man trapped in his own mental prison. Pat stands alone in the kitchen, leaning back against the stove. Roald sits unmoved with cigarette in hand as the young apparition turns to him.
Chapter 7.
Roald glances up. Outside, a postman rides a red bicycle up a country road, his post bag hung between the handlebars on its front. In the kitchen, Pat still stands alone, leant against the stove. As if waking from a trance, she turns round and lifts a pot, but drops it and holds her hand.
Damn it.
Cigarette in hand, Roald looks round and presses his pencil into the electric sharpener at his side and stares off into the distance. The ghostly schoolboy watches him sadly. The postman now rides his bike up the pathway towards the doll's house, stepping off its side as it comes to a halt. Opening the fridge, Pat removes a wrapped packet of butter and gingerly presses it against her palm. Holding a bundle of letters in a large brown envelope, the postman approaches the front door of the house. Inside, Pat looks up, then walks from the kitchen.
Morning, Mrs. Dahl.
There you go. Oh,
thank you.
Mrs. Dahl, I just wanted to say about your daughter. Sorry, you've got two, haven't you?
I have two, Tessa and Olivia. Olivia is her name. That's her name. It's Olivia. I'm sorry, my husband won't let us say her name, so.
Well, that's stupid.
Yes, it is stupid, isn't it?
As the man nods sympathetically, a tearful Pat steps forwards and hugs him tightly, causing him to look slightly awkward.
I'm sorry, we're all going a little mad in here.
Breaking away from the impromptu embrace, Pat smiles appreciatively and hands the postman the wrapped block of butter. He looks down at the strange gift. In the frosty garden, Roald kneels digging in a raised vegetable patch with a trowel. Pat appears out of the house dressed in a checked coat, black trousers and boots. She carries a hat in her hand as she walks across the grass towards her husband. Roald looks round.
Butter beans have a hankering for them.
Nothing's going to grow now.
Eh?
What are we going to do?
Get some tinned ones out.
No, not about the damn butter beans. Do about us. Or don't you care?
That's not fair.
What's fair got to do with it? Now, I think about Livy every single day.
Please.
No, our daughter has a name, and I am going to use it. Even the postman thinks it's stupid.
I am trying.
Well, try harder. How do you think it is for me, with two children scrabbling around my...
Oh, you want some help with the kids?
Oh, that would be a start.
Ah. Fine. All right.
He glares after her, then throws down his gloves as he watches his wife pass the empty birdcage. Now inside the house, the author sits alone in the kitchen, staring down blankly. A figure appears in the distance of the hallway, approaching. It's the blonde-haired Tessa. Wearing a blue dressing gown, she walks towards her father.
Where's Mummy?
Gone for a walk. Breakfast.
The author pushes himself up out of his chair and walks slowly towards the fridge. Pulling open the door, he claps his hands together, then rubs them before reaching in. A thick streak of cloud lies low over the top of a large swathe of brown forest. Pat walks alone amongst thick brown ferns. She wears her checked coat and brown fedora. Stopping briefly, the statuesque actress stands silhouetted in profile against the white sky beside her before moving off. In the kitchen, Tessa stands with her father at the cooker. As the young girl stirs, the writer looks away, then back to her, before standing upright with eyes open, as if coming to a realisation. Turning away from Tessa, the haunted-looking Roald slowly walks out of the kitchen. Sat on the hob, a frying pan appears into view out of which dance orange flames. Tessa waves a small hand over the top of it in an attempt to extinguish the fire, but has no effect. Turning, she sees her brother Theo stood nearby and jumps down from her stool. Outside in the garden, an approaching Pat breaks into a run.
Come on!
Roald! Tessa!
Smoke fills the kitchen as Pat rushes towards the children, lifting Theo and quickly leading Tessa out. A glassy-eyed Roald lies on his side in bed, staring straight ahead.
Roald! Roald! Roald, what the actual hell were you thinking?
You answer me.
Answer me! Answer me! Hell, no! Answer me!
Leave
what is
me
the
alone.
Matter with you? What is the matter with you?
The watching Tessa rushes away as Pat continues to hit the body inside of the unresponsive author. The worried-looking young girl steps into a dark cupboard and closes the door over. The lifeless Roald lies on his front as an exhausted Pat rests on top of him, her cheek placed upon his shoulder.
You fix things, Roald. That's what you do. Now, when Theo had his accident, you bust him around until you fixed him. And I loved you for it, my dude. But I can't do it anymore. You have to fix him. Roald, you have to fix it before it's so broken that it can't be fixed anymore.
Pat remains draped over Roald's side, her hand holding his, as she tenderly kisses his ear. The writer's eyes are shut as his wife pushes herself up and leaves the room. As she does, Roald opens his eyes. Daytime. Rain falls and wind blows the trees nearby to the writer's white brick shed. Inside, Roald sits with a rolled-up sheet of paper in his hands. He looks to the corner of the room at the ghostly schoolboy, who sits atop a wooden barrel knocking his heels against it. Looking away, Roald begins to unroll the paper. The schoolboy is shown sat beside a teacher and other pupils in a school photo. Roald looks back to the small boy, who loosens the knot of his tie, then back to the photo. Unrolling more of the sheet, Roald's gaze moves along from the schoolboy to focus on a teacher sat two seats along from him with arms folded. Now a car appears travelling along a wet country road, trees of a forest on either side. In a warmly lit room, Pat and Roald look down at a small silver-framed black-and-white photo showing Queen Elizabeth II's coronation.
It's crazy to think your old headmaster crowned the Queen of England.
Married her, too.
Good to see you again, boss.
Spark's gone out of you, hasn't it, Dar? Completely understandable in the circumstances. And you must be Mrs. Dar. My sincerest condolences.
Thank you. Please call me Pat, Your Grace.
I understand you're an actress.
Yes, that's right.
My. Well, there you are.
Thank you for taking this time to see us.
Not at all. Of course. Anything to help.
This has been very difficult for Pat. Well, for both of us.
Yes. But the fairer sex always feels the loss of a child more deeply.
Yes, Roald has been weathering all of this so much better than I have.
At least I haven't been asking the postman for his opinion.
You don't mind if I...
Actually, I do.
The chastened Pat removes the cigarette from her mouth, places it back in a cigarette case, which she then returns to her bag.
So, two daughters,
And a son, Olivia and Tessa and Theo.
You can imagine how this has left us all.
Bereft.
Yes, he can be a right old sod at times, can't he?
Who?
God.
God?
You told us that once at school.
Me? Absolutely not.
I'm probably mistaken.
Most definitely.
Roald now reaches in his pocket and produces a packet of cigarettes. Realising his mistake, he quickly returns them to whence they came.
Anyway, you must take comfort from the fact that your little,
Olivia.
Olivia, yes. Olivia is blissfully happy in the kingdom of our Lord. The way I like to look at heaven is to imagine where she was happiest on earth and then multiplied a thousandfold.
Well, that's the garden, isn't it? She was always happiest in the garden, wasn't she?
With her animals.
Then that's where she is now. In God's garden. The most wonderful garden imaginable. Without the animals, of course, but beautiful, full of ripe...
I'm sorry. Excuse me. What do you mean without the animals?
Not allowed. Animals have their own afterlife.
You are joking.
It's hardly a joking matter.
But then she wouldn't be happy.
Sorry. Not me who makes the rules.
No, not without Trilby. Not without Rowley.
No. The rabbit and the dog.
Definitely no dogs allowed.
No, Rowley needs to be running through the garden with her, both of them, running with the sun on their backs, so she's not so alone.
Yeah.
No dogs allowed. Christ, what sort of miserable bloody God doesn't like dogs?
Now back in their car.
Sorry, forgot Pompous arse he was.
No dogs in here.
Ha 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 ha
to me. Oh, Livy! Livy!
That's right. That's right.
She touches his face before they embrace again.
Thank you.
The lid of the wooden chest containing Olivia's belongings is lifted open. A hand moves a cuddly toy cat and board game box to reveal the small ragdoll Matilda before picking it up. Tessa is in the garden. The small blonde-haired girl skips around the grass, then lies down on her back. Her father appears carrying the doll in his hand and stands over her holding it out.
Matilda!
She's mine again?
She always was.
Tessa holds her doll tightly.
I'm sorry.
Daddy's sorry?
Yes. And sorry for shouting about the birds, too.
Sorry a second time?
Do you forgive me?
Yes. And I'm sorry a second time, too. I wish I hadn't let them go.
I was just thinking, perhaps we could wander down to the village and buy some chocolate.
Both together?
If you'd like.
Tessa nods, now in the village.
It's a silly name.
Well, no sillier than Rock Hudson or Morris Teapot.
No one's Morris Teapot.
Well, I'll have you know that Morris Teapot happens to be a very good friend of mine. Sells carpets in Clendenno.
Have you still got the owls who make chocolate?
Oh, yes, you didn't like them, did you?
No, they're too slimy.
Well, it's just as well that Daddy's the writer, eh?
I can't unthink what I thinked.
But you're a child.
So isn't it a children's story, then?
He takes this in before they enter the sweet shop.
Hello.
Morning.
Tessa stands before the counter, large jars set upon it.
Two gobstoppers, please.
Right.
One never lasts long enough.
Rold looks at her, then stares down.
That's very true.
Stepping across to her father, Tessa takes his hand, causing him to smile. The grey-haired sweet shop owner slides a white paper bag over the counter to the small girl. Now a piece of chocolate is broken off by Roald and placed in his mouth as he sits in his shed writing a cup of coffee in his other hand. In the house, Pat walks down the short hallway into the kitchen, a brown envelope in her hand. Opening it, a sheaf of papers is inside along with a note that she looks down at. Nighttime. Pat sits up in bed, papers resting in her lap.
What's that?
It's just something Marty Ritz directing.
Not thinking of doing it, are you?
Well, perhaps.
Not too soon?
Well, you're working.
Me working doesn't mean leaving the kids, does it?
No, I suppose not.
Now, look, if you really think you're ready, then we'll deal with it. Like we always do.
Roald settles down in bed, facing away from his wife. A fresh yellow pencil is pushed into an electric sharpener. The pointed lead tip begins to write on lined paper. Four lines are filled. Now almost the whole sheet has been written on. As Roald writes in his shed, the ghostly schoolboy spins his cap on his finger, pacing up and down before him. A sharpened yellow pencil continues to scribble on the lined paper as a newly focused Roald is consumed with writing. The author works with his head down as the young apparition sits facing him, patiently watching on. Suddenly, sun shines through the window, illuminating the boy and casting a golden light onto the writer, his long writing tray across his knees. Out in the garden, the birdcage is empty, its door wide open. In the writing shed, the sun still glows through the window onto the ghostly schoolboy and the inspired author. Lifting his coffee cup, Roald salutes the happy young boy. Now leafing through a bound manuscript, Roald wears a long trench coat as he walks purposefully up the paved path towards his house. Inside, Pat is asleep in bed. Roald enters the bedroom, the sheaf of papers in his hands, and sits down on the side of the bed. Holding it out, the author places it down by his wife as she wakes. He stares at her expectantly.
You want me to read it now? Of course not.
They both smile before he rises and leaves the room. Pat reaches a hand over and picks up the manuscript. Later, Roald waits outside the room smoking a cigarette. Sat up in bed, Pat is reading. In the hallway, the author flicks his cigarette into an ashtray. His wife smiles as she settles back on her pillow, still engrossed. Roald stubs out another cigarette. A relaxed Pat continues to read. A restless Roald leans on a windowsill. Now in her dressing gown, Pat appears in the hallway carrying the manuscript.
Darling.
Do you like it?
Like it? I love it. I absolutely love it.
I was getting so nervous.
It's brilliant. It's funny and twisted.
Twisted?
In a good way. It's twisted and original like only Roald Dahl can be.
No, you're not just saying.
No. Really, it's really, really wonderful.
Oh, good. Now, any notes, however small, because I want it to be right.
Well,
I know, too many kids. I thought 9 was too many, so
no,
what
no,
I did
I,
was...
I think 7 is perfect.
No. Instinctively, I think that 7 is still too many. I think there should be fewer, but I just don't know which one to lose.
Perhaps...
Go on, say. I won't take offence. Well, because this one's got to sell.
Well,
I know what you're thinking. The bills are piling up, and this can't be another stinker like Peach.
When did I say Peach was a stinker?
Well, not in so many words, but sometimes it's what's not said that's more important. Say, Roald, how many copies of Peach did you sell? 2,633.
Please don't do this to yourself.
God, what was I thinking?
Roald, kids are going to love this.
Kids? What have kids got to do with it? It's not kids who buy kids' books. It's adults. It's parents buying for their children. And parents don't want twisted.
Look, you're getting yourself in a state over nothing.
Nothing? Oh, no, you're right. This is nothing. This is just a bunch of meaningless scribbles. You know what we do with a bunch of scribbles? We do like this.
Stop it!
Stood downstairs, Tessa and Theo look up as papers fall from above.
Stop it!
I'm done.
Christ! You're like a petulant child!
Did you say when I stopped was the day you'd file for divorce?
Oh, don't tempt me!
At one end of the hallway, Roald disappears as Pat storms off in the other direction. Daytime. A classic white Jaguar car speeds down the road between the woods towards Roald and Pat's house. In the garden, Roald appears out of his writing shed and begins to cross the frosty grass. In the house, Pat is washing dishes in a white stone sink. A man wearing glasses and a flat cap appears at the window before her.
Oh my God, Marty, what are you?
So this is where you ended up, huh?
Oh, Marty, what on earth are you doing here?
Just passing.
Through Buckinghamshire.
Oh, so that's where I am.
Come on, sit down. I'll make you a cup of tea.
Roll around.
Somewhere.
I can't begin to imagine what. What you two have been through.
Don't.
Of course.
As Pat walks away from the table to prepare a drink, Marty glances round.
Anyway, I hear you like the script.
Oh, I do. I love it. It's one of the best things I've ever read.
Thought you might say that. So, who do you think should play Alma? With Shirley MacLaine?
Not got the mileage.
Bancroft?
Bancroft is a housekeeper. You kidding me?
Well, Shelley would be good. She might have the right sex appeal.
Marty. I am flattered. I am.
Tell me you don't know how to play Alma.
Of course I know how to play Alma.
Tell me you don't want to play Alma. Come on, Pat. You're the only one I can see doing it. And Paul. You're the only one he can see, too. And you know what these big shot Hollywood stars are like?
Seriously?
Pat, I'm sitting at your kitchen table in the middle of Buckinghamshire. How much more serious do you want me to get?
Oh, I don't know. You know, we're getting there, but...
But what?
Well, there's the kids for a start.
Bring them with you. I know a great nanny. Well, that's a lie, but the studio... Oh,
Marty, Marty, Marty. If only it were a few months down the line.
You didn't tell me we had a visitor.
Roald, you remember Marty?
In the neighborhood, were you, Marty?
No, I came to persuade Pat to be in my picture.
Oh, yes, Hud Bannon. It's a bloody awful title. You're going to have to change that.
Already have.
It's just Hud now.
So you see Pat as a housekeeper, do you?
Oh, you read it, huh?
I skimmed through.
What do you think?
I think L.A.'s a long way to go for 20 pages.
Well, you know the saying, quality, not quantity.
Didn't start out as an agent, did you, Marty?
Oh, now you're getting nasty.
Trust me, you haven't seen nasty yet.
Oh, I work in Hollywood. Trust me, I have.
Yes, well, and I commend you.
Roald.
I certainly wouldn't have the gall to traipse all this way to offer Pat something that's so... Shit, what's the word? Beneath her.
That's two words.
That's enough, Roald.
Man asked my opinion, darling.
That's right. And opinions are important, so here's mine. I've been here for you every step of the way since Livy died, and you haven't been here for me once. Something has to change, and I am going to change it, because let's face it, you never will. You're too consumed with your goddamn self-pity. So you stay here, Roald, and you wallow. You bark at the world for all I care. Marty, thank you. I'm all yours.
As Marty looks down, Pat and Roald glare at one another across him.
Congratulations, Marty. I'm glad it hasn't been a wasted trip.
Roald leaves the room as Pat looks at Marty.
Pat, you're being ridiculous. You're not ready and you know it.
Oh, mighty Roald. You know me so much better than I know myself.
Oh, fine. Take the first bit part that comes along.
It is not a bit part.
It's 20 bloody pages. They won't even notice you're not there.
Pat glares wide-eyed.
Thank you.
What for?
For making it so goddamn easy to go.
Oh, all right. Oh, all right, fine. I'm sorry, okay? I was an arse. I'll call Marty up. I'll apologise. I just think it isn't the right time.
Will there ever be the right time?
Roald slowly turns to the doorway as Pat composes herself.
Perhaps we both need some space.
Space? Why do we need space?
To think.
What's there to think about?
Pat stares back at her husband. A chastened Roald slowly moves across the room and stops, facing her across the bed.
Now look, Pat, I can change. I can.
Yeah. People always say that at the end.
A worried Roald stares at Pat. Now she looks out from the back window of a car Theo and Tessa sat beside her as it pulls away up a muddy track. Roald stands alone watching his family go, then turning. His face shows a haunted expression as he passes through the open entrance to his garden and closes over a metal gate. Now in the kitchen wearing a dressing gown, he ambles towards the fridge and opens the door. Later, dressed in a cardigan, he appears upstairs and looks out of a window. His head drops and he turns away, his gaze remaining down as he walks along the hallway. Now sat on the bottom step of the staircase, he looks at the phone before his head drops. Alone at the kitchen table, the author lights another cigarette. A willow-pattern tea set lines a wooden dresser resting against a wall. Now a door opens and Roald enters Tessa's empty bedroom. Stepping towards her bed, he picks up a picture that sits upon it. On it are three figures stood between trees. He suddenly looks up. Nighttime. The writing shed in the garden is visible through the spindly branches of a tree. Inside, Roald stands over a desk, a small lamp illuminating it. The bulb flickers and goes out. Rolling up his sleeve, Roald reaches towards it and adjusts the fitting, causing its bright light to return. Smoke from a cigarette drifts upwards as the author grabs a notebook, picks out a pencil from a pot, and begins to write.
Awful drive. Lorries kept holding us up on narrow roads. Got to hospital, ambulance went to wrong entrance. I kissed her. She was warm. Why is she so warm? Of course, he said. I left.
Roald writes, the lamp on his desk lighting his work before placing down his pencil.
We all become stories in the end.
Roald looks round.
So don't you think she'd like to be remembered with a happy one?
The young boy smiles, leaving the author deep in thought. Daytime. The Hollywood sign is visible on the hills in the background as Pat sits staring out over the mountainous landscape before her. Theo sits on her knee and Tessa has stood beside her.
You're glad we came.
It's pretty.
No, I've always felt at home here.
What about Daddy?
Daddy, not so much.
Does that mean he won't come?
Would you like him to come?
I don't want him lonely.
Back in England, Roald is dressed in a long coat and brimmed hat as he walks on a woodland path, his grey dog trotting off in front of him. He looks ahead, watching the canine disappear, in the same way that Olivia did. The author stops. Now ducking under the low branch of a green leaf-covered tree, Roald steps forwards, approaching the abandoned building that proved a favourite of his young daughter. Moving past its high concrete side wall, he walks by the back fence. Coming to a halt, the tall man stops, turns and bends down, levering back the piece of corrugated metal covering the hole. Peering in, the large open room is still overgrown with forest undergrowth. Light streams in the large windows as Roald stares up towards the high roof. He moves to shut over the hole, then stops and half smiles, looking up at the ceiling and noticing the white birds from the garden cage flapping up towards a large opening. His eyes are wide as his gaze falls back down. Closing over the hole and getting to his feet, Roald walks quickly away up the forest path, a satisfied smile forming on his lips. Pink clouds streaking the sky above, a large lawn stretches away from the front of an Art Deco house, sandy beach and blue sea visible below. At the garden's edge, Pat sits on a wall smoking, gazing down at a manuscript in her other hand. A sign over a stone entrance archway reads Paramount Studios. A woman with dark rimmed round glasses turns from a sheet of paper showing a dress design.
So, you're worried?
Well, not so much worried. Worried's what goes on in here. It's more here, I'm all a flutter.
And what about down here?
What's my gut tell me?
It's what I always listen to. You know, I can't say I wasn't surprised when I heard you were playing Alma.
I know. But I think I know her. Well, at least I thought I did.
And now you don't.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. Maybe I agreed to do this for the wrong reasons.
Get out of your head. Thinking like that'll be the end of us all.
It's easier said than done. Paul wants to meet me tomorrow to go through it with Marty. And Marty's gonna see right through me.
You know, these leading men only see themselves.
Nighttime. A dark-coloured car pulls up outside the grand white Art Deco house. Tall, rounded glass front windows are illuminated, and a staircase is visible through them. The back door of the vehicle opens and Pat steps out.
Mommy's home!
She hangs up her cream hat. Now she appears through a door.
Hello?
Looking down, Pat spies Tessa beneath a sideboard.
Well, what are you doing?
Shh. We're hunting a man.
Well, that sounds terribly dangerous.
It's
Pat looks across the seemingly empty room. Tessa climbs out and begins to crawl on all fours across the floor. Roald grabs his young daughter and hugs her on the floor.
No, wait. We've frightened Mummy.
What are you doing here?
Well, I'm a bear. I've been attacking her village and she's an Apache brave who's hunting me.
Tessa, go and play in your bedroom.
But I haven't killed the bear.
You can kill me later.
Tessa looks to her unimpressed mother.
Okay, but if you eat any more villagers, I'm going to be very cross.
All right, you are.
Pat reaches a hand towards Tessa as she passes, but finds it pushed away.
What happened to us both wanting some space?
Well, if you recall, that wasn't both of us.
Pat walks past her husband towards a table laden with bottles. Dropping ice cubes into a tall glass, she lifts a bottle and pours a clear spirit into the vessel.
I'll have what you're having.
Roald watches as his wife remains with her back to him.
I'm sorry we started out all wrong, haven't we?
A stony-faced Pat turns and places a glass down in front of him.
How's the film?
Couldn't be better.
Well, that is good. Well, if it's all the same to you, I'll stick around. Pick up your laundry, help with the kids, that sort of thing. You never know. It might come in useful. Ginger.
Roald watches Pat while he drinks as she looks away. Morning. Sun shines on the large white Art Deco house beside the sea. Inside, Roald sits in the window seat alone, looking out at the blue water.
Yes?
Would you be angry if I'd done something?
That would depend entirely on what it was you'd done.
Her hand is behind her back.
I only did it so Mummy could read it to me.
She hands him his manuscript.
You always told Livy your stories and not me.
Roald looks up, then back at the papers.
Are you angry?
Looking up, he shakes his head.
No.
Roald takes a deep breath.
What did you think?
I still don't like the owls.
I see. Well, anything else?
Well, maybe river can be chocolate instead. There could be this big marshmallow, a mountain, and then maybe butterscotch river.
I like that. That's very good.
A large red-roofed tiled house. A maid in a grey dress and white pinafore approaches and opens a large wooden front door.
Patricia Neal for Paul Newman. Come in.
Pat enters the grand house and looks around at the white stone walls.
Right this way.
Thank you.
Now in a long hallway, Pat follows the maid walking over a colourful rug. In a hazy room, a man in a blue shirt leans down over a pool table, then breaks off. Marty stands against a wall.
There she is.
Paul, oh, it's so great to see you again.
Pat. Oh.
Marty.
We thought you might have gotten lost.
But only in this house. It's enormous.
Thrilled to have you on board, Pat.
Oh, I'm thrilled you wanted me.
So, Pat likes the script, don't you, Pat?
Oh, absolutely. I adore it.
Glad to hear it. Me too.
Great.
So, as we were saying earlier, Paul, I think what Pat can bring to the part...
So how come it took you so long to say yes, then?
Paul.
I'm just curious, Marty's all. Scripts like this don't come along every day. When you agree, Pat?
Of course.
So, it's natural to wonder... why all the gaming...
Marty leans against the table, looking at Paul. Pat's eyes blink repeatedly, appearing flustered.
So? How come it took you so long to say yes?
You may have heard my daughter, Olivia.
What does someone say to that?
Oh, you don't need to say anything.
Shit happens, right?
Yeah. Shit happens.
So I've got a crazy idea. Let's talk about HUD. You got a favorite scene, Pat?
Favorite scene? There are so many of them. Well, there's the car and, well, the bus station.
I love that scene. That's some great writing. You have a book yet?
What? Sure.
Up for throwing some lines around?
Paul, you're not being fair. You haven't given the lady any warning.
She said she's off book.
Sure, no, I'm ready.
Well, looks like we're losing a good cook. Maybe should have boosted your salary a little. You ain't letting that little ruckus we had run you off, are you?
As far as I can get on a bus ticket.
Claiming I'm the first guy who ever stuck his foot in your door?
No.
First wine I've ever got rough, huh? Well, I'm sorry. That ain't my style. I don't usually get rough on my women. Generally don't have to.
You're tough on everyone?
Rough.
What?
It's you're rough on everybody, not tough. The clue's in the line.
Okay, all right.
I don't usually get rough on my women. Generally don't have to.
You're rough on everyone.
That's all they tell me.
You want to know something funny? It would have happened eventually without the rough house. You look pretty good without your shirt on, you know. You look pretty good without your shirt on. The sight of that through the kitchen window made me put my dishcloth down more than once.
Why didn't you say something sooner? Don't remember you, honey. You're the one that got away.
Paul pulls Pat against him and, leaning down, kisses her.
Wanna go again?
Paul smiles.
Nah.
Pat appears deflated as he turns away.
Play pool, Pat?
The sky's a mixture of yellow, orange and blue as the sun sets on the horizon, reflecting on the sea.
How was your day, dear?
Oh, just peachy.
You want to talk about it?
Really not.
I'm guessing it didn't go so well.
Well, that's the understatement of the year. Probably checking on Shelley Winters as we speak.
Oh, I'm sure that's not true.
Unfortunately, I can't even blame him. I thought I had her.
Well, I did say...
Did say what?
That Alma probably wasn't for you.
Is this you being supportive?
Well, I mean, she's not what you're known for, not a fox fur in sight.
Is that supposed to be funny?
Well, all I mean is she's a complex creature. She's not had an easy life.
And what? I have?
She's sexual, she's confident, but she's been through the ringer. She's been used, she's vulnerable. That's a lot to ask of any actress.
Screw you, Roald. I get her. I do.
Well, getting her's one thing, playing her's quite another. I mean, right now. What with Livy and...
No! Alma has known that sort of pain her whole life. It's there on every page. Livy is the reason I can do it.
Then what's the problem?
Pat looks surprised as Roald slowly steps towards her.
What are you doing?
I'm just stating the obvious, darling.
You bastard.
I don't know what you're talking about, Pat.
Why didn't you just come right out and say it?
Would you have listened?
You're an idiot.
Placing her hands on his shoulders, they kiss. Breaking apart, Pat smiles before they kiss again. As Pat stops once more, her expression changes.
No. No kiss.
Not even a little one.
No, that's it. Not even a little one.
A concierge opens a door for Pat as she enters the lobby of a grand building. Passing two large film lights, she approaches a set of stairs and begins to ascend. The camera pans up to show the staircase forming into a spiral above. In a large hallway, Marty and Paul are near two elevator doors as Pat appears.
Paul? Marty?
Is everything okay? We weren't expecting to see you.
I know. What was wrong?
Wrong with what?
The bus station.
Oh, we were just talking about that. Paul and I have an idea. We might go in
the
a different...
The scene is fine. It was me. I was all wrong.
No, Pat.
Marty?
Marty steps aside.
All right.
Paul looks to Marty as Pat readies herself. Now a cigarette hangs from the actor's lips.
Looks like we're losing a good cook. Maybe should have boosted your salary a little. You ain't letting that little ruckus we had run you off, are you?
As far as I can get on a bus ticket.
Claiming I'm the first guy who ever stuck his foot in your door? First one who ever got rough, huh? Well, I'm sorry. Ain't my style. I don't usually get rough with my women. I generally don't have to.
You're rough on everybody.
So they tell me.
You want to know something funny? It would have happened eventually without the rough house. You look pretty good without your shirt on, you know. Side of that through the kitchen window made me put my dish towel down more than once.
Why didn't you say something sooner?
And no kiss. You just walk straight to the bus and not even look back.
Pat looks at Paul in expectation.
Yeah. That is the bus station scene.
Marty nods as Paul looks back at Pat. She smiles as he breaks into a grin. In the garden of their house by the sea, Rhod sits writing at a table under a parasol as Tessa and Theo play on a rug beneath a canopy of sheets hung over chairs above them. Rhod places a cigarette in his mouth. Dusk. Back in England, Rhod and Pat's blue car passes down the road between the woods towards their home. Lights shine from the windows of the house. Pat sits reading Rhod's manuscript. Sat on a sofa, he watches her with a look of nervous anticipation. Worry creeping into his expression, he lifts a glass of red wine and takes a drink.
Last page.
Sat by the fire, Pat finishes up reading, closes the pages of the manuscript and looks at Rhod.
It's all right. I know it's good this time.
Do you know how good?
Any notes?
You know, I do have one.
Oh?
I promise you won't change a single line.
Rhod smiles as an excited Tessa runs to her mother and jumps in her lap. The author beams watching them. Captions read, April 13th, 1964.
The nominees for Best Performance by an Actress are Leslie Caron in The L-Shaped Room for her adroit study of a girl in technical difficulty. Who allowed us a glimpse of the Late Late Show in Paris. Natalie Wood is in love with a proper stranger.
Rhod is carving a carrot. Tessa appears out of a doorway carrying Matilda.
Patricia Neal in Hub for her portrayal of the slovenly, affectionate housekeeper.
Rhod ascends the stairs.
Rachel Roberts in This Sporting Life for her portrait of the repressed young widow.
He enters his bedroom carrying a tray.
The winner
is the king of breakfasts.
Now, don't go into labour or something, but...
Patricia Neal.
You've only got one bloody Oscar.
No! No!
Didn't I say you'd squeeze every last drop out of those 20 pages?
Is that what you thought?
She holds the carved carrot Oscar statuette.
Isn't Mummy clever?
Roald touches his wife's face tenderly as sat beside her mother on the bed, Tessa bounces around. Roald rests a hand on Pat's pregnant stomach. A spring day. Now in his writing shed, Roald uses a sharp knife to slice open a cardboard box. Opening the lid, Roald removes copies of books as the ghostly young schoolboy joins him, picking one up.
Mr. Dahl, did you have any idea just how successful that book was going to end up becoming?
No, none whatsoever. Never have. I just hope someone likes them.
I have to say, a great many people all over the world love Charlie and Chocolate Factory particularly.
Yes, it does seem that way.
In fact, many people have called it one of the finest children's books.
Well, I don't know about that, but I'm quite happy with it.
Hearing the noise outside, Roald gets to his feet, briefly glancing at his ghostly companion before approaching the door out to the garden. Opening it, he stops and turns back to the young schoolboy, who looks up from reading his copy of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, before slowly fading away. Roald steps outside, closing the yellow door. Stepping across the garden, he approaches a smiling Pat who holds the young Theo in her arms. Tessa stood beside her.
Perhaps there's a part of me that became a storyteller so I could choose what happens next. Because, of course, real life doesn't let you do that. Over the years, I dedicated books to all my children. To Lucy, to Ophelia, to Theo, to Tessa. And to Olivia. 20th of April 1955 to the 17th of November 1962.
Small white captions appear on a black background. When Olivia died, there was no measles vaccine in England. Once there was, Patricia and Roald became passionate supporters of the campaign to immunise children. The end. Thank you.